Dave, what is this?
Do you want me to yell, this is Sparta?
Yes, I do. I'm feeding it to you.
This is Sparta!
Okay.
Ready?
Do it. Oh, wait.
Fucker. Fucker.
No, no, seriously. Okay. Okay, ready, go.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the real... what are you doing? You're killing me.
Sorry, it was not intentional.
Are you going to interrupt me again? Are we good to go?
Nope. go.
Okay. Hey, everybody, welcome to the Real DMC Podcast. DMC stands for Dave, Marks, and Colin. Although today, it is just the Real DC Podcast, because it's just Colin and I. We are here today to continue our, I don't know, is it an ascent? Is it a descent into the Zack Snyder film vortex? Actually, I guess it started with the Snyder Cut, right? That's where all this started? Is that right?
I think so. And I would probably call it an unhealthy and somewhat strange obsession.
Right. Yeah, because we went from the Snyder Cut, and we've done podcasts on all these films, and then we watched Army of the Dead, and we had some thoughts about that, and then we said, well, you know what, we should go back and watch Zack Snyder's first film, which was the remake of Dawn of the Dead, and then at that point we decided we were just in it, and there was no escape, so I think we're probably just going to run through most of his films at this point.
I think we've done probably half of them, so yeah.
By the way, I'm actually excited to talk about Watchmen at some point, so that'll be a good podcast. I actually really like that movie.
I would actually probably like to do that one.
Well, maybe we'll do that one next. In the Real DC parallel to the Real DMC podcast, perhaps Watchmen is coming up. By the way, so we are seeing a big spike in our listens, and we'd love to hear from you. So if you guys want to join us on the realdmc.com site and post a comment about one of these episodes, or send us a message at feedback@realdmc.com, or find us on Twitter @RealDMC. We'd love to get your feedback. And since Marcus isn't here today, normally we say, you know, please submit feedback about Colin and how much he sucks. But in this case, it could be Marcus, since Marcus isn't here.
Yeah, Marcus sucks.
Well, today we are here to discuss Zack Snyder's second feature film, and it's based on Frank Miller's well-known graphic novel, 2007's 300.
We Spartans have ascended from Hercules himself, taught never to retreat, never to surrender. Taught that death in the battlefield is the greatest glory he could achieve in his life. Spartans, the finest soldiers the world has ever known.
It's quiet now. They came from the blackness.
Be afraid! Sparta will burn to the ground! A thousand nations of the Persian Empire descend upon you.
What must a king do to save his world?
Instead, ask yourself, what should a free man do?
Threaten my people with slavery and death.
This is madness.
I only know that 300 Spartans give their last breath to defend it.
Tonight, we dine in hell!
We're in for one wild night.
By way of general introductions, the film maintains actually a 7.6 rating on the IMDb, and I actually think that might be one of the highest ratings for any film that we've done on this podcast. It's definitely a very positive, healthy rating.
Wait, 7.3 is the highest that we've done?
No, 7.6, actually, in this case.
7.6, but what about, like, say, Unforgiven, LA Confidential?
Colin, I'll have to go back and check those numbers. You may be right.
Please do. 7.6 is pretty high.
Well, surprisingly high. I mean, does that number surprise you, I guess? Because it kind of surprised me when I saw it.
I think after I watched the movie, I'm a little bit surprised. But given how sort of groundbreaking it was and how popular it was, I'm actually not very surprised.
Yeah, I'm kind of wondering how much of that is fueled by nostalgia versus people that are kind of watching it today. But getting back to the film, so in terms of its performance, it was a huge hit. So the budget for the film was $65 million. It actually made a $210 million domestically from the U.S. box office, and it went on to make $456 million worldwide.
I'd call it a hit.
It's a huge hit, and actually, apparently it was the highest rated R comic book movie until Deadpool in 2016 knocked it down.
So that was like nine or 10 years.
I don't know how many R-rated comic book movies came out during that time period, but it definitely maintained the top spot. The other interesting thing about that is that Warner Brothers was apparently lobbying Snyder pretty hard, and their original direction was to have him make a PG-13 film because they wanted it to be available for a broader release in terms of the audience. Snyder, to his credit, held the line and said, "No ways, I want to make an R-rated film." By the way, he also told his fellow writers to, quote, "dial up the weirdness." And I'll say, confirmed. I think.
Yeah. they delivered.
Yeah, there's some really interesting, just weird visuals and looks. And it's all actually, it's fun to watch and it's pretty interesting. But there are a few moments like the elephants and the rhino and some of the animal stuff in particular that's just kind of out there.
You know, so what if we piss off the Iranian community and the entire country of Iran? We don't care. We want weird.
When this film was released, there was quite a backlash from Iran and the Persian community because they did not like the portrayal of Xerxes or Persians, I guess. But it seems kind of strange to me, honestly, that they would have that much of a reaction over what was an ancient army, but you never know.
I sort of understand it. They take that to be a very proud part of their history and heritage. I guess it's sort of like if Iran made a movie about the American Revolution and George Washington had like nipple clamps and a lot of piercings and was into orgies. So I understand it. I do. I think some of the rhetoric around American politics or trying to like take down Iran and all of this stuff, I think that's a bit overblown.
No, that's what I'm saying. I don't see that. I mean, I can see where anybody who's watching this movie might just take an angle and go, wow, somebody really wanted to make Xerxes a pretty weird dude. You know, because in that they succeed.
Absolutely. I think it's a better movie for it because I find it very interesting, no matter how grotesque it is. By the way, I'm not saying that nipple piercings are grotesque. There's some aspects to this movie that we'll talk about later that certainly are out there.
Is there anything that you would like to admit to the real DMC community in regards to your own nipples?
Yes, I have three of them. No. I do not have any nipple piercings.
Okay. No. It's good or bad. It's up to you. Dude, no. Just live your life, man. Have a good time. Prior to this rewatch, when was the last time you actually watched this movie?
I think it was probably back when it came out. Yeah, I don't think I've actually seen it since then.
I definitely have not seen this movie since probably, maybe I saw it one other time after it came out. So I definitely did not see this movie in theaters. It would have been right around the time that, probably 2007, 2008. It's not a movie I've ever owned. And for whatever reason, it's not a movie that I had really gone back to. Maybe I'd watched it one other time, but found it very entertaining. But for whatever reason, just not one that hit my rewatch meter to go back to.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it was just because I was like, okay, I've had enough of abs for a while. But no, I really did like it after seeing it. Yeah, I think it was just, I sort of forgot about it a little bit. I mean, there was certainly comic book movie after comic book movie, so.
Yeah, does this get, obviously the subject matter is very different, but in terms of the film style and all that, do you have an association with Sin City to this movie?
Oh, absolutely. And I love Sin City. And that one I have watched many times. Now, did Sin City come out before this or after this?
Yeah, I thought Sin City came out afterwards because I thought the sequencing before I looked it up was that 300 came out and it was popular and it went on to make a lot of money. And then they're like, oh, what other Frank Miller properties can we adapt? But apparently Sin City was actually made in 2005. And I'm not sure that the style of the filmmaking it's definitely not the same. I guess the process that they used for 300, so Jeffrey Silver, who was the producer on the film, explained it as, you crush the black content of the image and enhance the color saturation to change the contrast ratio of the film. They nicknamed it the crush as the process they used. And Sin City is definitely not the same, but there's a lot of similarity. Sin City is mostly black and white with splashes of color, so that's a little bit different. This is, there's obviously muted color throughout, but definitely big similarity between the two.
Yeah, and I think that's probably mainly because of Frank Miller.
So Sin City, I think, made about $75 or $76 million domestically in the U.S., and apparently Warner Brothers was anticipating the same type of box office return for 300. And so they were not expecting what they got in terms of the financial success. Didn't they try to do one other Frank Miller property after this?
There was a follow-up to Sin City. Were you thinking of something else?
No, maybe that was it. And that was not a particularly good movie. Is that right? The Sin City sequel?
It was not nearly as good as the first one. Yeah, I was disappointed. I really loved Sin City.
We should maybe do Sin City at some point. That's another movie that I haven't seen in a long time.
Yeah, I think that would be really interesting. It's so funny because I'm not a comic book guy. I don't read graphic novels. The only ones I have read are Watchmen and The Dark Knight.
Returns?
The Dark Knight Returns? Yeah, yeah.
Those are two very good ones, so that's good.
Yeah. Oh, The Spirit? Is that what you're thinking of?
Oh, maybe that's The Spirit. Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. And that, I think, flopped, if I recall.
Did I even see that? I can't even remember anything about that movie.
Did Frank Miller direct that, though? Just out of
curiosity? Yeah, he directed it.
Maybe that's what he said. He directed a movie, and I don't think it did well. There you go. Question answered. Just a couple of things about the production of the film itself. Zack Snyder used a process where he took images from the actual graphic novel, and he did some light animation on it, and he put them all together. And then apparently he had Scott Glenn do a voiceover. And what he did was he took that into Warner Brothers, and that was part of his pitch. So he made kind of a motion comic with a Scott Glenn voiceover, and Warner Brothers was pretty interested, but they wanted him to film one small sequence from the movie. And what he did was it was a 360-degree shot of one of the Spartans fighting the Persians. So, you know, it's kind of swinging the spear and taking a couple guys down. And so it was those two pieces of content for the pitch that Warner Brothers looked at and said, yeah, this looks interesting. Let's go for it. So just the fact that he animated the entire comic, or at least a big section of the comic, to actually get it made, I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the other thing, too, is that I guess Michael Mann was working on a film about the battle of, can you pronounce it for me?
Thermopylae.
Was it Thermopylae?
Thermopylae.
Thermopylae, thank you. Okay, yeah, so the Battle of Thermopylae. Apparently, once 300 got going, Michael Mann abandoned the project. Does make me wonder a little bit what a Michael Mann-directed Battle of Thermopylae movie would be like. That'd be something I might be interested in seeing.
It would have been nothing like this one. This was, I'm pretty sure, going to be a straight historical epic based on a book called Gates of Fire. I feel like it would have been something along the lines of Troy, clearly not the same visual style. That would be really interesting just to see a Michael Mann version of an ancient battle. If he's still interested, I say go for it. Zack Snyder's version, they took a lot of fictional license. The reasons why and the explanations, I think, are actually very good ones. And I'm glad he did this version because I think it's very visually interesting. That said, this is a really, really interesting battle from a historical perspective. So I'd love to see it as just a straight historical epic type of film. And I think something by Michael Mann would be really, really great.
Well, why don't you just, throw out a couple of the interesting things that you discovered when you were doing the research on the history.
So first of all, Thermopylae, the actual place in Greece, that did in fact exist. It no longer exists the way it did 2,500 years ago. By the way, we're 1 year off the 2,500 year anniversary of the battle. It would have been really great to have done this last year.
That's why we're doing this podcast, actually. Happy 25th or 2,500th anniversary, Battle of Thermopylae.
Anyway, today the coastline is much farther away. But back then, it was very, very small. The actual name translates to the Hot Gates or the place of hot springs, because there is actually hot springs located there and still there today. You can go bathe in those hot springs or maybe like die in them. I don't know how hot they are. Probably pretty hot. I'm not advising anyone to go out.
Can you bathe in the blood of your enemies when you go there?
Maybe. There might still be some.
That's the extra package.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about Thermopylae, because of all the sedimentation as well, the actual site of the battle took place about like 20 meters below the current surface.
Oh, yeah. I read that.
I'll tell you, this movie is about 300 Spartans basically taking on an army of 1 million Persians.
Right.
Well, that's all wrong. It was actually a force of about 7,000 men, but there were 300 Spartans made up essentially the vanguard. There were also many other men from different Greek cities and regions, Thebans and the Thespians and the Achaeans. And then the Persian army, originally they were saying it was like 1 million, maybe 350,000. Today, they think it was actually more like 100 to 150,000 soldiers.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Not quite as big. Hard to tell. It did take place 2,500 years ago.
How many elephants and rhinoceroses did they have that were battle hardened?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know.
Yeah, a couple other quick facts that I thought were interesting. So the vast majority of this film was actually filmed in Montreal on a soundstage. And apparently there's one scene where the Persian soldiers are running. Apparently that was filmed in Los Angeles. So the vast majority of this movie is Montreal soundstage with a little Los Angeles thrown in.
Yeah, it was all blue screen, a little bit of green screen.
90% blue screen versus green screen for whatever reason. And apparently, I guess that had to do with the colors of the Spartan uniforms.
Yeah, the capes. Apparently, red looks better against a blue background than green.
So Tyler Bates was the composer. And apparently, there was the threat of a lawsuit. So Elliot Goldenthal was a composer on a movie that was made in 1999 called Titus. But apparently, Tyler Bates may have lifted some music directly out of that score. It was not Acrimonious, so it was Warner Brothers put out a statement basically crediting Elliot Goldenthal, and I'm sure he probably got some cash out of it. I think the score is actually really interesting and effective. I like it.
You love the guitar.
There's one part of the guitar that made me laugh a little bit. Overall, I think the music is pretty interesting. And then my last interesting fact about the film is it has, well, it's hard to exactly calculate, but it has an estimated 585 on-screen deaths. Yes, there are an awful lot of people that die in this movie.
I think that's just a fraction of those who died during the actual battle. The Greeks didn't really have that many casualties, but the Persians had a lot more, like in the thousands. One other thing about the production, and hopefully I'm not saying something you already said, because that would be, I'm not paying attention to what you're saying.
That's okay. That just means we're doing one of our normal podcasts.
But did you mention that this is basically like a shot-for-shot adaptation of the comic book?
No, I did not mention that.
Well, it is.
Yep.
I thought that was really interesting. It wasn't every scene, but Zack Snyder was really framing scenes by holding up the panels and getting it just right. I mean, had that ever been done before? I mean, did they do that in Sin City or any other comic books, like, you know, like the 1978 Spider-Man TV movie? I mean, I'm pretty sure they didn't do it in that one.
You see a lot of Snyder's, I guess, what would you call them? Snyderisms in this movie?
Snyderisms, yes.
Definitely the comic paneling. I mean, that's a big one. And then this is where he really begins, I think, to experiment with the speed ramping, right? So we didn't see that in the Dawn of the Dead remake, but there is a ton of that here, particularly, you know, all the fighting sequences. Speed ramping is that fast to slow motion. It's a very cool stylistic effect. I mean, I think he uses it a lot in this movie, but I think it works well.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the first time you might see it is when the Persian messenger comes to Sparta. Leonidas kicks him into the giant hole in the ground.
Yeah.
And that might be the first time I ever saw speed ramping. Still didn't know what it was 10 years later until you educated me. But yeah, speed ramping. They filmed it with this thing called superimposition chroma key technique just to try to replicate the imagery of the original comic book. There's a bit of a graininess to it. It's not very super detailed and clear, but it sort of has the texture of paper, right?
Yeah, it's interesting because I was trying to think as I was watching it, is this something that really appeals to me or am I finding the whole experience slightly off-putting? And I mean, I like the movie. I think it's a good movie, so it's not that. I'm just trying to think of, you kind of have to embrace the style to really, I think, get into this movie because, you know, there's a lot of after-the-fact animation and it's, I don't know, obvious isn't the right word, but it's a specific choice. And so you kind of got to just roll with the style. And I think the film visually is actually quite striking. There are several shots that are just pretty impressive. The one that I'll just call out now is the arrows in the sky. They do it twice, right? Because they do it at the end. But that first shot with all those arrows in the sky, I think is pretty badass. What do you think about the overall style? I mean, does the aesthetic appeal to you?
Yeah, I really like it. I feel like Sin City had a bit of that as well.
I remember when I was watching Sin City, I had that same experience where I'm like, is this working for me or not? And I mostly thought it did.
It works for me a lot because it takes me to the realm of fantasy. This is not the same world that we're in. And I like it as a visual style. I don't think I'd want to see it in every movie,
right.
But it works for the movies that I've seen it in. I never got tired of it or anything. It didn't take time to get used to. No, I really liked it a lot.
It's not like it was shot in, what's the aspect ratio that the Snyder cut was?
Oh, 4:3.
Yeah, it's not like it's in 4:3 or anything like that.
I think that would have done this film a disservice.
You want to talk about the cast?
Let's do it.
I guess we can start with Gerard Butler as Leonidas. I'm sure this was the movie that broke him big. And he's pretty spectacular in this movie. I mean, it's a fun performance, gravitas. He has a lot to work with as Leonidas in terms of made of steel, and they give him all this very flowery dialogue.
This is where we fight!
This is where they die! Remember this day, men, for it will be yours for all time.
He's the warrior king and all that. I think the performance is great, and I think he totally carries it off.
I've never seen a performance like this where someone showed their teeth the entire time they were talking throughout the movie.
Because he has lots of clenched mouth delivery, you mean?
Yes. I loved him. I mean, I was like, who is this guy? I've never heard of Gerard Butler before when I saw this. He's a big action star, but he's not like a big actor. I mean, like I know him from like Rock and Rolla, The Olympus Has Fallen and London Has Fallen. Hunter Killer is a recent film of his that I actually liked. The one film that I really like him in a lot, and I know you're not, you've got problems with this, but it says Big Nick in Den of Thieves. I love that character, and I really sort of like that movie a lot. I know you got problems with it, but I like it. I wish, and it's sort of like Big Nick, he's the King Leonidas version 2,500 years later.
Den of Thieves, it's a fun movie, but it's kind of like if you take Heat and then mix it up with the Fast and Furious universe in a way. And if you like shake that up and then pour it out, I think you get Den of Thieves.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I'm not saying it's Heat.
It's a cheesy version of Heat. The problem I have with that movie is the end shootout. A bunch of law enforcement guys that just open fire in the middle of a packed freeway on ramp. I mean, that makes no sense whatsoever. It would never happen.
Of course it would never happen, but it happens.
Is this Gerard Butler's best movie?
I'm going to say Rock and Rolla.
Okay. I haven't seen Rock and Roll in a long time, but I do remember enjoying it. All right, well, why don't we move on to Lena Headey as Queen Gorgo?
I did not know Lena Headey at the time. I think she was like brand new. I didn't never heard of her before. And then I never heard of her again until she was cast as Cersei Lannister in Game of Thrones. And now she's like, everyone knows who she is. But of course, we have to talk about her amazing performance in...
Dread.
That's right. Mama...
I didn't realize that I had seen so many Lena Headey movies and before I saw her on Game of Thrones. She's really good in this movie. It's a really good performance. So.
I've only seen her in a few movies, but she's always great.
Yeah, she's really good. Very, very strong actor.
Yeah.
And then the big surprise to me upon rewatch was all of a sudden Michael Fassbender shows up, and apparently this was his film debut, which I didn't realize. It's a hell of a debut because, wow, Fassbender's just ripping it up in this movie. I'm surprised.
Well, certainly as an action star, because that's really all he's doing.
Maybe what I mean by that is the size of the role. He has a pretty significant role as Stelios, right? I mean,
all the way, including
at the end. I mean, he's the guy that cuts down the guy in front of Leonidas before he throws the spear.
Yeah, I certainly did not remember him from 300. I think the first movie that stood out to me was Inglourious Basterds. And then from that point on, I knew exactly who he was. Yeah, I was like, oh, God, Fassbender's in this?
Well, and if you want to see his strongest performance when it comes to flute playing, I recommend Alien Covenant.
Hold it like so, nice and easy. And blow into the hole gently, like so. Watch me. I'll do the fingering.
There's got to be at least 3 to 5 minutes of flute playing in that movie.
I do like Fassbender. He's one of my favorites. But he's not as awesome as the actor who played Delios.
David Wenham?
I love David Wenham. Ever since The Lord of the Rings, I've loved David Wenham.
That's because you love Australian actors.
I guess I do. I guess I do. Him, Carl Urban, all those Australians. I know him so well. I love his voice. I mean, it's a chance for Faramir, Captain of Gondor, to show his quality. I mean, I just love that line.
Now when I see him as a character, I just think, what's the dealios?
What's the dealios? Yeah, I thought that too, unfortunately.
So one last person I would point out, just because I want to talk about his character, which is Rodrigo Santoro. So he plays Xerxes. Apparently his voice was digitally altered to make it a full octave lower, which makes sense when you hear him speaking throughout the film. I also have to believe that they somehow did something to increase his flamboyance by about 500% and maybe give him a light serial killer aesthetic. Like, that's what I would say. Because, man, Xerxes in this movie is weird.
They did dial up Xerxes to like 11. Yeah. He's even like, I don't know, 9 feet tall? I mean, it's out there. It's totally out there.
He's standing at what feels like a full foot and a half taller than Leonidas and putting his hands down on his shoulders. And there's a whole bunch of little bits of Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs that I see in Xerxes.
Yeah, I could see that.
I'd fuck me. There's a lot of that there. So,
well, that voice, yeah. I mean, that super low voice. Yeah, definitely. Now, I actually know Rodrigo Santoro from another movie. Oh my God. Yeah, that's him. That's him. It's Carl from Love Actually. You have no idea who that is, but that was my call out for Emily. Yes. Yeah, Carl, the Laura Linney love interest.
I'll take your word for it.
Yeah.
Okay. Anybody else in the cast that you want to highlight before we jump into it?
Fuck yeah. Hey, McNutty. It's Dominic West as Theron, the villainous counselor from Sparta. I just saw he is going to play Prince Charles in the next season of The Crown.
All right. Anybody else from the cast?
Nope. That's it.
All right. Well, then you ready to jump into this thing?
Yeah. Do you want a plot summary?
Sure. Go for it.
All right. The plot revolves around King Leonidas, played by Gerard Butler, who leads 300 Spartans into battle against the Persian god king Xerxes, who's Rodrigo Santoro, and his invading army of more than 300,000 soldiers. And as the battle rages, Queen Gorgo, played by Lena Headey, attempts to rally support in Sparta for her husband.
By the way, is it Xerxes or Xerxes?
Xerxes. I mean, that's Xerxes? How they pronounce it in the movie, Xerxes, yeah.
Maybe I just heard it as Xerxes.
You have a lot of trouble pronouncing some things. I'm not saying a lot of trouble, a little trouble, sometimes. Where did this battle take place?
Thermopylae.
Okay, but you had to have me say it for you, right?
Well, truthfully, you know what? I knew it started with a T. I just didn't even know what the word was because I didn't write it down. So, okay. The film opens. The one thing that I was interested in to see was this the start of Zack Snyder going crazy with his credits and the credit sequence? And you don't find that in this particular credit sequence.
Yeah, no.
The closing credits are actually pretty artistic and interesting, but not the opening credits.
Yeah, I was a little disappointed. Well, I guess Watchmen was probably the first one.
The Watchmen credits are actually pretty impressive.
Oh, yeah.
I like them.
Really, yeah. Really good.
As the film opens, there's a little bit of history that's being given as to, you know, who the Spartans are and some of their cultural norms. And so King Leonidas as a baby is being evaluated by somebody who is going to say whether or not he deserves to live or die, and he deserves to live. But what they show you in the bottom of this pit is a whole bunch of skulls. It reminded me a little bit of the Terminator, like the Terminator apocalypse with all the skulls in the ground.
Right.
Like it was very reminiscent of that. The killing of babies that were deemed to be unhealthy was a real thing back then. I didn't know that.
I can see unhealthy, but I mean, they were sort of like, oh, I don't know. He's got like a little mole on his butt cheek. He's gonna throw him into the pile.
I don't want this one.
I have to ask you, if you were born a Spartan baby, do you think they would have chucked you onto the pile of bones down below?
Do you think they would have looked at me and said, is this guy going to be a battle-hardened warrior? Is that a possibility here?
Yeah, or at least he's sufficient. We can mold him into a great warrior.
They might look at me and go, maybe that dude could pick up some firewood for us or something.
I know, like,
gather provisions.
I mean, it's either like, what about ditch diggers in Sparta?
Right. I mean, it's what if I just wanted to be a poet?
Yeah, see, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
We all like to envision ourselves as being battle-hardened warriors, but yeah, I'm not so sure.
Because I'm sort of thinking that, you know, they could not have just said, take every newborn baby. All right, well, I don't know. He's not going to make it in the army, so.
What's the evaluation criteria? I mean, come on.
I think it had to have been, like, if you were, and this plays back to a little bit of foreshadowing, but if you were deformed in any way, then
right,
they would throw you onto the pile. So that's historically, I guess you're saying that is accurate. Now, there were a lot of bones down there, and I have to wonder how much inbreeding is going on in Sparta.
Well, not only that, but how did the mutant dude, what is it, Epiphiles? Is that how his name, you pronounce his name?
That would be, sorry, I forgot his name. Ephialtes.
Oh, Ephialtes. Okay, yeah, thank you. There you go, pronunciation error. So how did Ephialtes survive then? How did he survive getting chucked in the pit?
I think his parents stole him away before he could be chucked under the pile. And so he was like a secret baby. Honestly, though, he seems like the perfect candidate for the pile. I don't know.
That's what I'm talking about. I mean, if there's anybody that deserves to be on the pile, it's that guy.
Poor Effie Altis.
Yeah, I think their baby killing system could use some quality control. I'm not sure that they're managing it too tightly.
Yeah. By the way, Effie Altis horribly deformed in all of this. Take the Hunchback of Notre Dame and make him even uglier. That you get Effie Altis. If I'm the real Effie Altis of 2,500 years ago, I'd be pretty pissed because he was just like a farmer boy who led the Persians over to find this back route, this goat path around the Spartans. So he was not deformed or anything like that.
But did you know that his name actually became slang in Greek after what he did?
Yeah. So what is it? It was like a slur, right?
Apparently was meant to mean nightmare or ultimate traitor.
Right.
That's what the name came to mean.
Oh, you mean like a Benedict Arnold?
One of those. Yeah.
Yeah.
Only in this case, it's Effie Altis, unless I'm pronouncing it, and then it's something else.
You're such an epiphany.
Epiphilates. Whatever.
Don't be epiphilating, man.
So you see Leonidas, who is, as a young boy, he's, I don't know, what kind of drafted into the official Spartan training, which is apparently also something that was real. I guess Leonidas had two other brothers that were in line for the throne. One, I think, died, and the other one went crazy. Since he was third in line, it was never envisioned that he would actually be the ruler. And so he went and was going through the Spartan training. So apparently he was one of the few true warrior kings of his day in terms of somebody that actually went through and had the full military training.
Right. What do they call it? Is it the Agorgo or something like that?
I didn't find it anywhere.
Well, it's just from the movie.
I didn't write it down then. How about that?
Well, why didn't you?
So there's a big sequence where he's out there as a young boy. I guess he's probably maybe 14 or 15 at the time. And he has a big spear, and they show him squaring off against what is supposed to be a wolf.
The wolf begins to circle the boy. Claws of black steel. Fur as dark night. Eyes glowing red. Jewels from the pit of hell itself.
But let me ask you this. What kind of wolf is that supposed to be exactly? Because that is a big fucking mutant scary wolf that looks a lot like the werewolf from American Werewolf in London, actually.
What I immediately thought was, oh, zombie tiger.
Oh, yeah. That's a good call out, actually. Yeah.
But yeah, and there was like, oh, no, it's a wolf. And then, yes, and they show the wolf in a lot of shadow right up front. And, oh, first of all, I think this wolf might have some hyperthyroidism. But yeah, he looks really scrawny but really frightening.
Yeah, his jaw, I mean, and the teeth that he has, he's like a saber-toothed wolf is what it looks like.
Yeah, well, this was 2,500 years ago, right? This is the time of cavemen, and oh, no, wait a minute. Yeah, no, there were no like saber-toothed wolves back then. But yeah, it's pretty frightening.
The young Leonidas kind of backs into a cave, and the wolf jumps at him, and then the wolf gets stuck, and then Leonidas kills him with a spear. So one thing I did look up was apparently, so Xerxes was a... there was a legend that as a boy, he was locked in a room with a full-grown lion, and he had to kill the lion.
Xerxes?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So there were some people who were wondering if maybe the script was actually referencing that legend and had just reversed it.
Oh, interesting. Potentially. I personally just thought it was a lot of foreshadowing because of the technique that he used to trap and then kill this wolf led him into this narrow passage in which he could then not get out and then just annihilated him.
It's a visual metaphor for the rest of the movie.
There you go.
Leonidas comes back and he has killed the wolf, so he's wearing the wolf pelt and he walks in through the snow and all that. All those visuals are actually pretty cool. And then it kind of jumps forward to where he's king and he's, you know, he's with his queen and things are good. And then some Persian messengers show up. The Persians demand...
All the god King Xerxes requires is this, a simple offering of earth and water. A token of Sparta's submission to the will of Xerxes.
Submission. Now that's a bit of a problem.
Or earth and water, which, doesn't that mean that they're just looking for some mud? Is that what they want? Like if Leonidas had scooped up a big thing of mud and handed it to him and said, hey, bring that back to Xerxes for me, does that actually, would that satisfy the request?
I think it's metaphorical, Dev.
So it's about mud. It's all about. So this is a big fight about mud, is what it comes down to. The Persian messengers are backed up to, I'll just call it a big murder hole because I'm not sure what that thing is. It's a big hole in the ground.
It's for when you conveniently need to murder or in this case when you conveniently need to kill the messenger, you've got a nice big murder hole behind you.
So I had a couple questions here, which is, how deep is that thing and how bad does it smell?
Well, I was wondering, is this a well or is it just literally some murder hole?
It's a murder hole.
It's very big. If it's a well, you know, you're just going to be fouling your own well by, you know, throwing a bunch of soldiers down there.
But that's why I wouldn't think that it would be a well. I think it's a designed murder hole.
It seems like it should be a well. It's like probably like right in the center of the Spartan city square. People go there. They get their fresh water. So this is a really bad idea. I'm just wondering, you know, maybe you should put up some railings around that thing. I mean, it's very dangerous.
It is very dangerous, right?
What is the code like in Sparta? I think it needs to be updated.
Leonidas yells, you know, "This is Sparta." And then he does that as he kicks the Persians into the hole. And one thing about that that I thought was interesting is that the line was not designed to be yelled. And so they shot it two or three times where it was supposed to be kind of said with quiet intensity. And Gerard Butler just wasn't feeling it. And so he unexpectedly on one take yelled it. And Zack Snyder saw him yell it and said, "Oh my gosh, let's go with that." And then so they did one more take with him yelling it. And that's what you see in the movie.
You know why? Because Gerard Butler's got big balls.
It's a nice moment. I mean, he definitely sells it.
It is a good moment. I liked the introduction of the messengers or the messenger and his soldiers. Just sort of the audacity to, you know, walk into someone's kingdom with the skulls of some other kings with their crowns still on the skull, just as right. a way to intimidate and say, basically, give up without a fight and we won't kill you. We won't torture your kingdom to the ground. And then he has the gall to say, like, "Hey, buddy, don't kill the messenger." It's like, I think you're sort of asking for it.
I think if you're on the front lines as a messenger in these situations, that's definitely a dicey job.
That's why they came up with the saying, "Don't kill the messenger."
Right. Still, though, it's a little bit of a tricky position.
Very tricky.
You want to be in the archery corps, or do you want to be a messenger? I'll just be some random archer, I think.
I think I'd rather be an archer. You're far away.
And, right.
yeah. Plenty of time to turn tail and run.
Exactly. So Leonidas wants to go to war and bring the full might of Sparta and Greece against the Persians. So there is a scene where Leonidas is actually trying to get the blessing of the oracle. He climbs up this mountain to get to where kind of usual group of or leprosy freaks kind of looking dudes, right? Where there's always these guys that have the mystical abilities, blah, blah, blah. And then there's a woman there who is supposed to be the oracle, and she is the beautiful one. There is one visual moment that's actually kind of cool because you see the oracle gyrating, and apparently what she says in the film is just total gibberish. Like, she just made it up on the spot. They film the technique by actually having her do it underwater, which is why the visuals when you see her moving her body and the clothes that she's wearing and how they're flowing. So it's actually kind of a cool visual, but that's how they did it, was by filming it underwater.
Yeah, it's very cool. And I was wondering, like, how her hair is just like sort of flowing and all this. Nice job. Very nice. Because she's also like sort of floating above the ground as she's, right. as she's dancing.
I felt there's a little bit of the Raiders of the Lost Ark opening the Ark moment, the imagery of the way that things are flowing. It reminded me of the spirits when they're out of the Ark and they come up in the face and then they turn into the skull and then people's faces melt. But before the face melting, like, there's a little bit of that visual style, I thought, the way that things are flowing around.
Yeah, I think it was the vapors.
Right.
They were basically drugging the oracle.
Right.
And then she went into this, some would call it an epileptic seizure, I think, because that's what they historically, that's sort of like what it was. Some of this is sort of historically accurate, and a lot of it's not.
Both Frank Miller and Zack Snyder are on record all over the place saying that they were trying to make an entertaining movie and not make something that is necessarily historically accurate.
Oh, and it's totally fine. Like, I have no problem right. with it. But if you want to know, first of all, the Ephors themselves, I mean, why is it like all these like secret religious counselors in movies? They're always like lepers.
That's what I'm saying. I mentioned that earlier. Were you paying attention?
I was, but did you actually say lepers, though?
Yeah, I was trying to get there. I think I made some sort of an attempt at the word leprosy. I'm not sure how it came out.
Oh, sorry. My bad. Never listening.
Leonidas looks like he has to climb a cliff to get up to where they are. In fact,
I was wondering the same thing.
At one moment, he actually jumps. Like, he has to physically jump and like grab onto the next rock above him to get up there. You know, how do these guys get their provisions? You know, why are they living up there? I mean, what's the storage situation like? Where do they go to the bathroom? There's lots of questions here.
My immediate thought was, all right, well, those guys, you know, they just like live up there and somehow they get the beautiful women to come up there and be oracles for them. But how is it that Theron and this Persian emissary got up there so easily.
Right.
I don't know if you saw the Persian emissary, but he had some heft to him.
Yeah.
I don't think he's going to be climbing up the mountain.
The whole situation about where it is a little bit goofy, but the scene and the visuals is actually, I think that's pretty well done.
It is. It's nicely done.
Yeah, Leonidas does not get his blessing, by the way, to march. And what you find out is after he leaves, the Ephors have been bribed by the Persians because you see some Persian gold coins that are spread out underneath them. And they're, of course, doing the usual sort of like cackling, like, I gotta get the money, right? Because those guys are always really weird.
And by the way, the Ephors in historical fact were just a council of 5 Spartan men who were elected on an annual basis. And they just swore an oath on the behalf of the city. They were basically a governing council. That's it. They weren't like some religious weirdos.
So Leonidas returns home and he lets his queen know that he's disappointed that he cannot take the whole army with him. They do have what ends up being a relatively gratuitous sex scene in the movie.
Some say gratuitous, others say very artistic and titillating.
Enjoyable. So, yeah. But then, so Leonidas, he says he's going to take a walk and he needs 300 bodyguards. So his plan is to leave with 300 Spartans, a couple of the actors we talked about, and then another, I guess, probably 270 male models that show up at the last minute just to join the march because everybody's looking pretty spectacular.
I guess Frank Miller said that, you know, he drew the comic that way, you know, with the way that they're dressed with this. Essentially is, I don't know what you would call it, like a codpiece and a cape and some shin guards. That's basically the uniform.
Can you imagine running into like a battle against arrows and spears and swords?
No.
And you're like, I'm just going to go topless. Fuck it. Yeah. I'm just going to go topless.
And maybe this was just like one big nightmare. Like, oh, where's my clothes? But yeah, they're missing their leather skirts and their chest plate.
The chest plate? Yeah.
Well, I guess they had helmets. I guess they did have helmets too.
Apparently all the Spartans had, what do you call the thing on the top? Is it a plume? What is it?
Yeah, we'll call it a plume.
Apparently all of the Spartans had that, but they only gave it to Leonidas in this movie because they wanted to make him a distinct character. So during the chaos of battle, you could easily pick out which one was Leonidas.
Smart move. I mean,
yeah.
Like, not everything needs to be 100% historically accurate. I get it. I don't really have a problem with the way that they're dressed either. Frank Miller said that he wanted them to really show movement and be agile and all of this. You know, he thought this looked a lot better and gave his characters that ability. And of course, Zack Snyder wanted to replicate that. I don't have any problem with that at all. I know, look, all you have to do is see them and go, okay, this is not historically accurate. It's fun.
So it's fine. It doesn't bother me. It's just sort of interesting when you see the picture of a Spartan soldier when you're doing the research and all that. And you're like, oh, okay, that's what they really look like. For me, it's more the mindset of, hey, I'm running into battle. I would like to have at least maybe a shirt on. I don't know. So if not some full armor, but that's just me.
I get it.
As the Spartans are marching out, they come upon a village that has been already been decimated by the Persians. The idea was that Persian scouts, I think, got up, or some sort of a scouting group got up and attacked. And what they find is that the Persians have been engaged in some arts and crafts. So they've been taking all the villagers, the dead bodies of the villagers, and mounting them to a tree. And so they come across the Tree of Death.
What was it in Hyperion? The Shrike's Killing Tree?
Or the Tree of Woe in Conan.
Good visual.
Yeah, the visual is actually cool. And there's one kid that is left in the city, and then he comes out. And I don't know if they're trying to basically say that he dies at that moment, like he dies in Leonidas' arms, or he just basically passes out. It's trying to set up, I guess, the Persians as a truly evil invading force that they would do this. So I think that's the intent of that scene.
Yeah, agreed.
So they do then get to the gates. They have a view of the Persian army. And one of the first things they actually see, they go to the edge of a cliff and there's a storm that's going on. You see a bunch of the Persian ships that are getting tossed and thrashed, and you see a bunch of people are drowning because of it. I do think that the reaction of the Spartan soldiers during this moment is pretty funny because Gerard Butler, as Leonidas, is standing there somewhat, you know, somewhat stone-faced, and all of the Spartans behind him are celebrating like you can't believe. So I thought that scene was a little funny.
Yeah, it is. I guess it was because they just wanted to show that Leonidas was like, hey, settle down. You haven't done anything yet. Again, historically, there was more than going on than just this land battle. There were concurrent naval battles going on.
Yeah.
We just don't see that other than, you know, just this massive armada. And it also looks like all these ships are lost at sea. And then, of course, the next day they say, oh, there's hundreds of thousands of Persians down there. That was just like a small fraction of the actual armada that they had.
They do look down at the camp, and the visual of the Persian army is also pretty cool, just in terms of the scale of what they're facing, because you think, holy shit, I mean, it really does look like 300 against a million in terms of the way that it's laid out in the film.
Yes, it does. Historically, there was like a lot more Greeks there. What ended up happening was that they knew that they were lost because the Persians found a way behind them. Leonidas, he sent the bulk of the Greeks away to basically retreat, and then they held it there with like, I think around 7,000 Greeks, 300 Spartans and another 7,000 Greeks. And they're the ones who lost. They all died.
I think this is the first time the Persian army sends out a group of scouts. And I think they might negotiate in terms of offering to have them surrender. I think this is where Fassbender does kind of the first flying jump. So this is where you see there are lots of sequences where, you know, the Spartan soldiers get pretty elevated in the air, and it's kind of cool. I'm not sure if they used wire effects or anything else, but there's a slow motion whip crack that's happening. It does make me wonder, by the way, how much of this movie by percentage is in slow motion, because it feels like a decent amount of it is.
I think most of the battle scenes are.
So there's a lot of slow-mo that's going on, and this is also where, you know, there's a great moment. It's a really great piece of dialogue where the Persian scout basically says,
1,000 nations of the Persian Empire descend upon you. Our arrows will blot out the sun.
Then we will fight in the shade.
And apparently that went on to be some sort of an official Greek motto that was used in the Greek army for quite a long time. Something about like being willing to fight in the shade.
Oh, well, this actually happened. Like, so Herodotus, who is a Greek historian, he wrote that when this particular Spartan soldier was informed that the Persian arrows would be so numerous as to block out the sun, he said, "So much the better. Then we shall fight our battle in the shade."
That dude was pretty awesome.
I'd say that quote lives on 2,500 years later.
Yep, that's some gravitas. That's some good dialogue.
Yeah, the other thing is that the Persian ambassador, he asked Leonidas,
"Spartans, lay down your weapons! Persians, come and get them!"
That's a real line. So that was, yeah, it was nicely done.
So this is also where Leonidas is approached by Ephialtes.
Ephialtes.
What's his name?
Ephialtes. What's his name? Ephialtes.
Ephialtes. Ephialtes, the mutant crippled dude who wants to fight as a Spartan. Leonidas asks him, you know, can you raise your shield? And of course, he can't. I find the Ephialtes character to be a little bit annoying. It's not my favorite part of the movie.
You don't think he's really cool?
No, I don't. I don't think he's really cool.
He's just way overdone. I mean, here's the thing. Like, he's horribly deformed. He's very, very ugly. He doesn't have any hair on him at all. But he's also, like, he's totally ripped. He's got a six-pack. You know, he just really can't move in the same way that everyone else can.
Maybe they went overboard on the prosthetics and they gave him, like, a second body on his back. It's like a reverse quad.
They really did. I mean, that's a huge hunchback. He's sort of like if the Elephant Man got ripped.
Right.
He just got shredded. Like, he was doing, like, PX90 and... He just wanted a beach bod. Sorry, dude. You're still really ugly.
You're still a mutant. Sorry. See, so after they have that initial fight, then there's a fun moment where the Spartans, they start taking the bodies and they basically build a wall of the bodies of the fallen Persian soldiers. There's a good moment after the battle ends where they're talking about the fact that they need to remain civil. And as they're doing that, the Spartan soldiers are walking around and stabbing the wounded Persians with the spears to kill them. And just super casually just like ending all these guys' lives too.
What's going on here? Just killing some wounded soldiers, eating an apple. Because like there's one guy, I forget who it was. I don't know. Just like sitting there like eating an apple, killing soldiers.
Yeah.
Killing wounded soldiers.
The casualness with which is laid out there in conjunction with the let's be civil dialogue is pretty funny.
Yeah. Casualness. There was one other thing. So before that, because I really like this. I think this was like one of the things that I most noticed from the comic panels. The Spartans are pushing back the Persians and they're pushing them towards the cliff.
Oh, to the cliff.
Ultimately, they're tumbling off the cliff.
Yeah.
And that was like a really great shot. And that was like, I think that was the one that the comic panel that I saw. And I was like, oh my God, the movie is just like the comic. Really, really well done. The artistry of the original, but trying to replicate that on screen, I think that was really, really well done.
Yeah, the visuals of all the bodies falling down into the ocean, it's pretty cool. It also shows you the power of the Spartans, because they basically just line up and basically just push these dudes right off the cliff. So
yeah.
There's a second big attack sequence, and this is where the Persians unleash that what they call the Immortals. That's the name of the type of soldier. Apparently, at one point, they reference that they're demons, but that's just, of course, it's just the costuming. However, I will say the costuming for those guys, I think, is pretty cool. They have silver masks on their face, and most of the costumes in this movie, I think, are really effective.
Those are great costumes. The masks, I think, they remind me of the comedy drama, those masks, you know?
Yeah, so, yeah, I know what you're talking about, yeah.
Yeah, these are for drama or tragedy, so the frowned faces. I mean, they're frightening.
They bring out a huge guy that's in chains. So somehow Xerxes has collected oversized mutants to like a bunch of like weird characters. This is where I think the weirdness gets dialed up, because all of a sudden they bring forward this guy that would probably have to be like, I don't know, like 8.5 feet tall, something like that. And he's this huge mutant. I have lots of questions here. In many movies recently, there is a trend to have like a mutant on a chain. You know, so they had it in Lord of the Rings, all the Avengers movies, right? All the aliens, there's always like a big bad like mutant dude. But like, what happens when you let that guy off the chain? I mean, you have to train him pretty good to like not attack you, right? So,
well, I don't know if they trained him very well, because I think he was pushing through his own handlers without a care. But you're right, because that's the first thing I thought when I saw him was, they have a cave troll.
That's a trope now, I guess, where the invading army has some sort of large, oversized creature or mutant man, something that...
And that's because it works. It's always fun.
And it would be scary, I guess, if somebody was in front of your house unchaining a large mutant. You knew that was going to go down, so...
They should have had that in the Bond movies back in the 70s, where they have Richard Kiel, like, as Jaws, but, like, on a chain.
There's one scene where they bring in what they call the magicians. What they're actually throwing is gunpowder, and so there's a scene where they knock one of the lit bombs back into the big pile, and there's a huge explosion. And then you see Xerxes from the distance, and he kind of he's having like this weird like kind of moment when he's watching it. I don't know. The Xerxes character is pretty weird in this man. So
I don't know. When they started lobbing bombs, all I thought of was, they're using artillery on us.
There you go. That's your Die Hard reference. What's great about this is it then cuts back to yet another weird scene, which is Xerxes is not happy with the progress his soldiers are making. And so he brings out his executioner to cut off the heads of some of his generals. The executioner is basically a Cenobite from Hellraiser. That's what this guy is. He's a big Cenobite.
Thank you. Because I was like, why does he look so familiar? I mean, he's grotesque.
He has what appear to be large, I don't know, what would you call them, like crab-like arms or something like that? Or
I will tell you, because I looked it up.
Okay.
This is from the 300 Wiki. His name is the Executioner.
Mm-hmm.
The Executioner creature has so many deformities that he must have been specifically made or bred for that role. He has massive razor-sharp blades for arms, multiple piercings, and appears to have hooves instead of feet.
So I'm going
to
go out on a limb and say that this is where some of the weirdness was dialed up a bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. And there's also, there's a little bit later that we'll talk about as well. But yes, definitely when you see the executioner. By the way, hello, spinoff. I want to see more of this guy. He's amazing. Like, literally, I think what they did was cut his hands off, pulled the flesh back all the way up to his elbow and just like cut it off, exposing just the bones of his forearm. And then they attached these long blades to it. It is so disgusting. It is sick. It's macabre. It's grotesque. I loved it.
One of the moments I had was, I don't remember this from watching this movie.
Yeah, I say I love it, but I don't actually love that stuff. But I think it works extremely well.
Yeah. Afterwards, this is where there is a scene where they have some elephants that they bring in to try and charge the Spartans. And the Spartans hit them with a whole bunch of spears. And then you actually see some elephants go off the cliff and impact at the bottom of the cliff, which I thought was kind of interesting. I wouldn't have thought that they would have shown that, but they do.
I thought they would have like splatted more.
I'd agree with that. Lots of mass hitting the ground there.
Yeah. By the way, we sort of flew through the meeting with Xerxes.
I do love the line where Leonidas says,
such an offer only a madman would refuse. But the idea of kneeling, it's, you see, slaughtering all those men of yours has left a nasty crack in my leg, so kneeling will be hard for me.
First of all, I liked how Leonidas just turns his back on Xerxes.
Yeah.
This god king who was literally a massive figure in front of him, resplendent in gold and jewelry and, you know, lots of piercings. And he just turns his back on him, like, very nonchalantly, like, just totally disses him. When he did that, there was a little bit of an awkward sexual harassment thing going on there between the two. Leonidas, he walks away from Xerxes, and you see him walking away. And at that moment, I swear to God, I went like, oh, Jesus, it's Superman. Because Leonidas has this red cape. He walks away, and you see the full red cape on him. And I'm like, man, what is it? Like, he looks just like Superman there. Huh. And so it's like Zack Snyder, he totally has this fixation, I think, on Superman.
I'll have to go back and check that out. That's look at
it. I didn't really notice it in other shots, like when, say, like they're leaving with the 300 Spartans or leaving Sparta and they're like marching off. But in that one shot, I was, oh, wow. He just looked like Superman.
By the way, side note on that one, the Man of Steel original trailer, one of the greatest trailers ever made.
Yeah, I'd say that was very well done.
Snyder does get Superman, at least some elements of Superman, I think. Or whoever cut that trailer actually really gets it.
I still think that Superman needs the red tights and the yellow belt, but whatever.
You just want the yellow belt.
I love that yellow belt.
So then there is this big second attack sequence. And this is where, so Stylios and Astynos, there's a big sequence where they're out there and they're fighting. So that's Fassbender and Tom Wisdom. That's his name.
Is he related to Emilio Estevez's Wisdom character? What's his name? John Wisdom?
John Wisdom.
Is it John Wisdom?
I'm thinking not.
I can't believe I made you watch that movie.
I know. Me too. It's all right. It's fine.
If you're going through a back catalog and you see that movie, I'm sure you're just scratching your head. It's like, what the fuck? Wisdom.
It was a punishment, just so everybody's clear. There's a big moment here where, so Astynos, he gets his head cut off by one of the Persians, and you see the head kind of fly through the air, and then you see the headless body before it collapses to the ground. And that's a dramatic moment because Astynos is the son of one of the other Spartan soldiers. I don't know the other Spartan soldier's name, but I'm sure his name ends with an S. That'd be my guess. So
I think his name was the Captain.
Dad gets a little frustrated at seeing his son's head get cut off. He tells Leonidas that he's filled with rage, and Leonidas is good with that.
I'm good with that.
Then this cuts to the Xerxes camp, and this is where the mutant dude, he goes over there. And
Ephialtes?
What was his name?
Ephialtes?
There you go, Ephialtes. Yeah, Ephialtes is the name that is going to be stuck in my brain for the rest of my life. Ephialtes. Ephialtes, I can pronounce it. Xerxes is apparently having a slow motion orgy in his tent. So there's just lots of women gyrating everywhere. Not sure exactly what's going on, but there's active gyration.
Okay, if there's one thing we can say about Xerxes, it's that this guy knows how to party. You've got goats playing the guitar, chicks without arms, mutilated faces. I mean, this is fantastic. And then he takes one look at Ephialtes, this hunchback, and he goes, hey, let's get this guy into a threesome.
Hey, I want some of that. You're exactly what we were looking for.
I expected to see the executioner like lying down on some blankets and being fed grapes by some Cenobites.
Let's just say he likes to hang. He has a weird scene going on. I guess we'll say that. So
he's definitely got a weird scene.
It's a very weird scene. He does promise Ephialtes that if he gives him the key to beating the Spartans, in this case, access to the location of the goat path where they can sneak and get behind him. He says that he can have whatever he wants in terms of, you know, riches, and Ephialtes also wants to wear a uniform. He makes that request so that he can be part of the army, and that's because Leonidas turned him down earlier. Here's what I thought about when I was watching the scene, which was, you have these poor slave women that are sex slaves, and then now on top of just being everyday sex slaves, they actually have to fuck this mutant Ephialtes. I mean, how terrible is their existence? I mean, I feel bad for these women.
Come on, Dave. You know we only got a hand job.
I'm not sure what went down. I'm not even sure that that's. I mean, you might get something on your arm, some sort of growth after that. I don't know. Yeah, good old Ephialtes.
They probably just like, which do I get first? Do you have sex for the first time or get my uniform? And they look at them like, give this man a uniform.
Go take care of the goat path first. Hopefully you'll die. And then he leaves and the women are like, Oh man, who's taking one for the team tonight? And meanwhile, like Xerxes is just standing in the corner going like, "Ooh, I'd fuck me." You know, it's like, I don't know what's going on in that tent, but it's like, yeah.
All I can say is the last thing you want to do is be tripping balls on acid and actually accidentally stumble into that tent.
Yeah, that tent. There is some stuff going down. So back at Sparta, so the queen, she's trying to influence the council. So she has an opportunity to speak to the council. And this is where, so Theron offers to help support her in that endeavor. But with her main goal is to get the entire army to march so that her husband will survive. By the way, apparently this entire Senate subplot was not part of the original Frank Miller novel. So this was all just added in after the fact.
Thank God, because if they'd cast Lena Headey and that was like the last you saw her for her, I'd be like, oh, this is lame. Like, I want to see
that would have been a bummer.
I sort of like what they did. You got to at least have a break from all the battle. It's good. And there was some, you know, stuff going on. But historically, there was this religious festival, the Carnia. Xerxes, being a smart tactician, decides, hey, this is a good time to invade Greece during their religious festival when they're not supposed to be going off to war. They actually did say, like, we got to hang back, but you 300 go off ahead, and then once it's over, we'll send the rest of the army. That's not what happened in the movie. The movie is, no, you can't go at all. We're not going to support you. This isn't like an illegal war. But again, we don't really care too much about the history here.
Yeah, it's a movie.
But I did like Dominic West's heel turn there because, you know, he says if he has his way with the queen, then he'll give his support to her. And then immediately the next day in the council chamber, he's just like, she's a whore. She tried to seduce me to get my vote. He's just like, dude, you're such a dick.
He is quite the asshole in that moment. And then, but I do have a question. He starts attacking the queen and saying that, she was going to offer herself to him and all that. But then she, in the middle of the council meeting, pulls out a sword and stabs him to death. When she runs the sword through him, a bag of Persian gold drops out and scatters on the floor, and all the other council members say, "Traitor, traitor." So my question is, why do you bring your Persian gold to the council meeting? That seems like bad planning.
Yeah, I don't think he thought that she was going to kill him either.
Stab him.
That's what I liked about this scene. Oh, big heel turn, and then, swift comeuppance. Don't fuck around with Spartan women, I guess, is the lesson to be learned. Queen Gorgo is being, she's sort of being advised by one of the counselors who's sort of like on her side. He's a supporter of hers and Leonidas. But man, I swear to God, he sounded just like Charlton Heston.
Yeah, he had a very commanding presence, actually. I liked that guy on screen.
Stephen McCaddy. He's a Canadian actor. But anyway, great voice.
So back at the gates, by the way, while the council meeting is going on, so they realize that they're getting flanked because one of the Arcadians comes in and says the Persians have discovered the goat path. And Leonidas, his reaction to that is that he tells the Spartans,
"Spartans! Ready your breakfast and eat hearty. For tonight, we dine in hell!"
I had a question about that as a motivational speech. Why are they all going to hell? What's happening there?
I think because they're going to die. They're going to Hades.
Aren't they going to die in glorious battle, and then wouldn't that avoid hell?
Well, they're not Vikings. They're not going to Valhalla. Everyone goes to Hades. Hell and Hades, it's not really going to hell and, you know, you're going to be tortured.
Is this where you give you a char on the gold coin and all that?
Exactly. They're going to the underworld.
Go across the river Styx, that kind of thing?
Yeah. But I think it was more like, well, it's going to be a long journey, you know, because you got to go travel across this river. Eat up, boys.
Well, and that brings us to the final battle. And so they do see Ephialtes in his uniform. I'm going to put uniform in air quotes as I say this, because his uniform was to dress him up as either a garden gnome or give him a dunce cap.
So. Garden gnome. Yeah, it was, I think when you look at the differences between uniforms between the Spartans and the Persians, you gotta lean towards Sparta.
Don't you think that they gave him a really dorky uniform as a way to symbolize the fact that he sold out, and what did he sell out for, and it was to look this ridiculous? Did you think, was there anything there? Because it seems very strikingly stupid, the costume. So I was just kind of, it seemed like they were trying to make a statement.
I think yes. I don't think it's totally obvious because, again, I did see those hats on some of the Persian soldiers. Yeah, I think he does look ridiculous. And I think the fact is, if someone's going to betray their own country, you're not going to get a lot of love and respect from the people that you are betraying them too. You know, right. You're happy that they did that, but they don't care. They want to make him look ridiculous.
If I was Effie Altis and I would say, hey, what do you got for me in terms of uniform? Because those immortals, they look pretty cool. They got the silver faces and they got some badass, some shoulder pads and some plate armor. What do you got for me? How about this dunce cap over here in the corner? It's just like...
Well, yeah, there you go.
And you'd be like, oh man, I shouldn't have sold out my city state. But as they are surrounded, so there's a pretty cool scene where all the Spartans are down on the ground and they have their shields up. They form a human turtle.
Yes, human turtle. Yes.
Which is pretty cool looking too. I mean, it definitely looks like a good defensive posture. But of course, at this point, they're way outnumbered. They're not going to win. So Xerxes has a messenger that comes out that is speaking for him and offers Leonidas the opportunity to be declared the warlord of all of Greece as long as he kneels to Xerxes. And so there's a scene at the end where you see, you know, Leonidas dropping his shield and dropping his sword or dropping his spear, and then he gets down on his knees, and it's, you know, done in slow-mo. It's pretty dramatic. It's kind of cool looking. And then he yells for Stelios, I think.
Yeah.
So he yells for Stelios, and so this is where Fassbender erupts out of the group of shields, and then he kills the messenger, and then that gives Leonidas an opening to take a shot at throwing a spear at Xerxes, who he just barely misses. I mean, he hits him because he kind of gets the corner of his mouth, and it actually cuts one of his chains that he has for his piercings, so that's kind of cool.
That's got to hurt, by the way. You have that ring just pulled right out of your nose.
Oof. Well, I remember when I read about this movie a long time ago, they were saying that was a significant moment, the fact that he is cut, because what they were trying to say was that he believed he was a god and he was immortal. And so the fact that he was wounded by man was a real thing. I don't know if that's a real thing or not. I assume that Xerxes probably knows he's human.
It's not just that. It's more for the sake of his followers and his subjects that he's pubbing himself as this god king. And then, yeah. Oh, shit. Hey, wait a minute. You mean our god king actually bleeds? Not a good look.
When Leonidas is down on the ground, he actually briefly has a vision of Maximus's house from Gladiator, because the choral music starts happening and there's some wheat that's there. And so,
oh yeah, right. I was thinking about that too.
Apparently, if you're in a historical epic and you are going to die and you're going to go somewhere in terms of the afterlife, or you're having some sort of a post-death reunion, there's going to be some choral music and some wheat.
And I do believe his, you know, thoughts of his wife and family.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So very, very similar to Gladiator in that moment. The other thing that I noticed that's kind of weird, and I went back and looked at this a couple times because I was sort of curious about it, but I swear that when Leonidas is on the ground that he puts on some eye makeup when he stands up at the end there. And if you look at his eyes, like his eyes are a lot darker and they look a lot different than what 2 minutes before in the movie. So.
Yeah. He's got some eyeliner on.
Yeah, he puts on eyeliner.
When he comes back up for effect, yes, he's got eyeliner on.
It's noticeable. At least it was for me.
That's the one thing about Gerard Butler. With that beard and the hairstyle that they gave him, he really did look like a classical Greek figure.
By the way, we forgot to mention that he has a rat tail, too.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, he has a rat tail.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I missed that. Well, Superman does not have a rat tail, so that might have spoiled the look.
Yep, and so his spear does not kill Xerxes.
I will say, though, that watching the spear go in slow motion, but you don't actually see the spear, you see the shadow of the spear as it travels towards Xerxes up these steps. And so it's a really cool shot of the shadow. You know, the shadow goes up and down these steps. I like that a lot.
The visuals in this movie are pretty great all the way through. That brings us to the end, and it ends with... So I actually went back and looked at it because I was curious, and I think that there are 27 or 28 arrows that are in Leonidas as he's laying on the ground after he gets shot. Because there's the second cool shot of, you know, all the arrows in the air, and I think I mentioned it at the very beginning of the podcast, but I really do think that the first Persian attack with the arrows where they're all in the sky, I just think that is a pretty incredible shot. I think it's really well done.
Yeah, it's really nice. Very well done.
Yeah, he doesn't survive, and so it's a bit of a sad ending. And so he had sent Delios home to try and rally the council, and so that cuts to the very end of the movie, and so this is where, so what you realize is that Delios has been telling the story of the fallen 300 Spartans, and he's using it as a rallying cry to get the Greek armies to charge and attack the Persian armies. The name of the battlefield is where the Persians were finally turned back in Greece. I can't remember the name of it. Do you know it off the top of your head?
I think it's Panera, you know, like Panera bread. No, it's something like that. Palea? Oh, yeah.
So they killed the Persians, and then they got a salad and a couple sourdough loaves to go.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that brings us to the end.
Yeah. So, by the way, as far as the narration goes, I really liked the use of the narration. First of all, thanks for using David Wenham, because he's got a great voice.
Oh, great voice.
What it does is it's sort of like, so we are seeing what Delios is telling the troops about the story of this battle. Like many narrators, it's very subjective. And so this is why this sort of explains sort of the fantastical elements, especially around the Persian army.
Right.
And I think that was a really nice use of narration, the subjective narration, in order to say, this is very historically accurate, and everything that's inaccurate, well, just blame Delios.
Right. Yeah. This is just his imagination running wild, basically.
Right. Never let facts get in the way of a good story.
He's pumping up the details to try and get the troops ready to go kill some Persians. From a trivia note, only 2 gallons of fake blood were used in this movie. All the other blood that you see is actually digitally inserted after the fact.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
A lot of the blood definitely looks really digital, but I was surprised by the only 2 gallons, considering that the Evil Dead remake used 70,000 gallons of fake blood.
Well, unfortunately, they didn't have like supercomputers working for them.
Or no, fortunately they did, because they did all those practical effects.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I guess you're right. Fortunately, they did not.
All right, anything else you want to talk about before we get to our final thoughts?
Yeah, so we talked a little bit about the history, I guess. So I always thought, after I saw this movie, and then it was obviously, it became sort of meme-worthy in terms of, the abs, because everyone in this movie's got like a six-pack, right?
Right.
And then it was, they just, they use makeup to create those effects. And then I read that, no, they did like 8 weeks of intense training for like all of these soldiers who played the Spartans.
The training was actually really, because I read a little bit about the training, and apparently it was the guy that trained them was a professional rock climber.
Yeah.
And what he did was he used different exercises for them to do every step of the way. So, because how if you exercise that same muscle in your body, it gets used to it and you get less results. So apparently the program that he put them on was, for 8 weeks, it was all these different intensive exercises that were not repetitive in a way. And so what that did was it ended up building a very balanced musculature.
Right, because then you could go from leg day to like Kegels day.
Right, so, they definitely got after it.
Yeah, and Gerard Butler said the training was the most difficult thing he had ever had to do in his life. It showed, it really showed. Those guys were fit, Jesus.
Yep, every one of those soldiers made me feel bad about myself.
Yeah, ditto. So the battle itself, the Battle of Thermopylae, is often taught to military strategists because it's a great example of the advantages of training, equipment, and the good use of terrain as force multipliers. Didn't Leonidas even say that when he was, not maybe in those words, but when he was sort of pitching his plan to the Ephors?
I think the idea that their numbers would not matter, right? Yeah. I think that was the way he presented it.
Yeah, so we talked about the Carnia. That's actually, that was a real thing, this religious festival. The Spartans...
Carnia is also a nice option if you don't want the chicken or the beef.
I think those are carnitas.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
10 years before, the Spartans did actually sit out a battle, the Battle of Marathon, against the Persians, due to the Carnia, because the military engagements were forbidden. So this time around, and they're not really sure if it was the religious council or the elders gave them a sort of a pass to go, or if they were just like so pissed off at not being a part of that battle, which the Athenians were victorious. But this time around, they're like, we're not missing this battle. And so that's why the 300 Spartans ended up going while the Carnia was taking place.
It sounds like Xerxes actually did make a very calculated
attack. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it seems like the way to go. Ironically, they did this 10 years before, and they were defeated during the Carnia by the Athenians, who said, apparently they said, like, fuck the Carnia. But I'm not sure if the Carnia was limited to Sparta or if it was like a whole Greek religious festival. These are like different city-states. They're all Greeks, but there's no Greece really, right?
Right.
It's all these different Greek city-states. All right. Well, that's all I have to say about the history.
All right. How about anything else you want to cover off about the movie?
No, I think that's pretty much it.
Okay. Well, I guess we can get to the wrap on our ongoing Zack Snyder Vortex. So the wrap for 300 in this case. Colin, your thoughts?
I think this is a really interesting movie due to the visual style. It's, you know, it's very much like watching a comic book, not only just the panels, but the way that they filmed it. It really was unique and groundbreaking at the time and wanted to see more, which is ironic because I didn't watch the movie again until, like, you know, how long has it been? Like 15 years, 16 years, something like that, whatever. I do think you have to take it with a small grain of salt because of the history. It's mostly right. It really falls under this sort of historical fantasy category. I mean, the Persians were really made to be just a bunch of strange fetish freaks. So I find that to be very interesting, though.
I'm Xerxes.
Sometimes it's a bit grotesque, but again, it's very, very interesting. I am not Persian. I'm not Iranian. I don't have any of that background, so I'm not offended by it, but I can understand why they were. I'm totally okay with it. I sort of feel like the historical fantasy bit, with the way they did this, the thing that popped in my head was I thought it was sort of like watching the Nazi goblins invade David Kessler's home in American Werewolf in London. You take something historic, Nazis, and just make them into just all sorts of weird.
Right? Yeah. That's an interesting comparison, actually.
Oh, it's very, very memorable.
That particular scene, that was one of the most shocking, scariest scenes I ever saw when I was a kid watching a horror movie. Like when that scene came on.
Yeah.
That totally nailed me at the time.
I mean, that whole movie. It scared the crap out of me. Yeah. And then I really liked, again, Delios's narration, specifically because it's not only is it well done, but it also gives the filmmakers sort of an out. And it gives them that artistic freedom that they need to in order to tell this story and be true to the comics, but also, you know, not have just a complete shit show where, although there probably were teenage boys leaving the theater going, man, those Persians are freaks. But whatever.
What's your letter grade?
I'm going to give it a B+.
That's funny because you and I are quite often aligned, not always, I mean, on our movies, but I was going to say, yeah, this is a B+ for me. What I find really interesting about this movie, watching it now, is seeing how Snyder has evolved as a filmmaker. This to me is really kind of the birth of Zack Snyder and the Zack Snyder style, right? So you have all of the slow-mo stuff, you have the comic paneling and the work that he did there. And that's another thing just in general I find very interesting about this movie is the fact that it's so faithful to the source material to the point like where you're actually taking shots from the comic. I mean, that's pretty cool. I don't think up until this point anybody had done that. I do think that, you know, all of the costuming and just the overall aesthetic of the film is very interesting. The costuming in particular is pretty crazy. There's a lot of the Persian stuff that is way out there. So, and I think that's, you know, we mentioned that Snyder said, hey, dial up the weird. And so definitely accomplish that. But then on top of everything else, I mean, it's just a very entertaining movie. It's the siege film, right? So it's a total underdog situation right from the get-go. And so that draws you in and makes it compelling and makes it interesting. And yeah, the history is, this is not the movie that you want to watch if you're trying to get a history lesson on what happened at the Battle of Thermopylae. But it's interestingly presented as something that is at least a historical moment. So it's sort of a fantasy within a real historical occurrence. That whole blending of that makes it really interesting. And then I just do think that there are some individual shots in the movie that the you mentioned the spear at the end, the arrows in the sky, even some of the moments where the armies are charging at each other and some of the fighting's going down. And the visual style is very compelling. So it's interesting and it's fun to watch. You know, you have to kind of settle into what the movie's going to be because, you know, it is all blue screen and green screen. That sort of plays with your eyes and your mind a little bit, I think, when you're watching it. But as long as you can settle into it and accept it, then it's pretty entertaining. And I had a good time rewatching it. I don't know that this movie is one that I don't necessarily think I'll be compelled to watch it again in a couple of years kind of thing, but I'm glad I watched it and had a good time doing it. So yeah, my grade is the same as yours, A B+.
I'm a little surprised that I haven't seen it since it came out. However, I'm glad I didn't because it was very fresh watching it again.
Right.
I didn't like it as much the second time around, simply for story reasons, but the visual style is still like pretty, very amazing.
Yeah, it's fun to watch.
Yeah, definitely. And I really like Gerard Butler and Lena Headey.
Yep.
And David Wenham.
And Michael Fassbender.
And hey, there's Michael Fassbender. Holy shit.
I think overall what you're hearing is a pretty solid recommendation for Zack Snyder's 300. Hope you enjoyed our conversation that was, for the most part, pretty complimentary. And as Colin and I continue our attempt to navigate the Zack Snyder maelstrom, we'll figure out what movie we're going to do next. Perhaps it's going to be Watchmen. And then Colin, once we get to the end of all of his movies, we're going to have to pick a new director to lock in on as our side project. So you got any thoughts there?
Ooh, I look at a new director? Oof. Well, yeah. I mean, I love Michael Mann, so and I keep goading you to do Heat. That would be fun, but that'd be like a 4-hour podcast.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I love this scene. I love this scene. I love this scene.
I'm sure we can come up with someone else.
We'll talk offline, figure out which director we're going to obsess on. If you guys have a recommendation, send us a message at feedback@realdmc.com. And otherwise, we'll say, this is the Real DMC Podcast, signing off. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye, everybody. Goodbye.
This is Montreal.
Oh, boy. Okay, I'm actually slightly unwell, but I think I'm doing better.
Hopefully you're a little under the weather.
Hopefully I don't throw up, in half an hour, but we'll see.
No. We're here to talk about 300. Zack Snyder.
So, what'd you think of this movie?
I got the mouth sweats.
I think I'm gonna hurl.